ceasefire in these talks that were being held in Cairo and Paris and other capital cities. And what they wanted to do was release the prisoners that they hold in small tranches, kind of adhere to the good faith of the Israelis on the ground. But it appears with this UN resolution that a rabbit has been pulled out of the hat and the carpet has been pulled from under Hamas. It's just my personal opinion, but we have gone from what seemed to be a hope for a ceasefire between 6 weeks and 6 months, which could then possibly be extended, because once the guns go silent, it's harder to turn them back on again. And what we're looking at is possibly a two-week ceasefire. We're looking at food for hostages, which has been the stated goal of the Zionist regime and the Americans right up until the UN vote that was vetoed 3 days ago. I think Israel can say what it wants in the public domain. I think they are delighted that this draft resolution has been passed. They will have all their hostages potentially released in one go. And I believe once that happens, Netanyahu has two stated aims. One, to free the hostages, as he calls them, and the second, to destroy Hamas. What an effect he may have is a release of the hostages, which kind of negates the pressure and leverage that he's under from his own constituents in Israel, who aren't heard about the deaths and the massacres and the rapes in Gaza, but are only concerned about the 150-plus prisoners.
Well, everything will be determined by the definition of the word hostages. If I were negotiating it, I would be treating the Palestinian prisoners, 7,800 of them, I'd be treating them as hostages. And when the resolution says the release of all hostages, I'd be saying that's all the Israeli captives and all the Palestinian captives. We'll see how that works out in coming days. Thanks for that, Fra. Let's go back to the wall. Nargis is in London. She has a question. Splendid hat, Nargis. You need to wear a hat to come on this show.
First of all, George, congratulations.
Thank you.
You won. You're a fighter for truth.
Thank you.
And secondly, I wanted to salute and give a great salute of honor to Gaza and to Palestine and to all the forces of good who are now fighting and facing the forces of evil. We should correct now. The masks are all fallen, and we should correct Bush Jr. when he said that he was going against the axis of evil, but he was leading the axis of evil, actually. And we should also tell him that it's not God who spoke to him at the time. It was Satan.
Indeed.
And fortunately for the Israelis now, there's how I see it is the end. Pack and go. It's now time to give what belongs to the Palestinians back, their land, their identity, their history, their roots. They will never go anywhere. All the maths say that with the axis of resistance to that I salute too, from Yemen to Lebanon to Syria to Iraq to Iran to the silent ones, because we don't know who are the silent ones also here. And Israel is becoming a liability. The Israel was the one of the largest and most powerful tentacles of the Zionist octopus. I always like to remind you about the Zionist octopus. And this tentacle is becoming a liability now. And thanks to South Africa, I applaud them so much, because it's thanks to them this time, you know. The scandal went so wide, all over the world that now not everyone wants to be found in, I don't know, a Nuremberg-style tribunal or court that will happen soon. And you have politicians starting to pull their pins from the game one by one.
The Nuremberg would have to sit in permanent session. Narges, thanks for that. Loki, where do you stand on this recent Security Council resolution? Does it provide, in your view, any basis for at least a lengthy cessation of the genocide?
So my understanding of it at this stage is that it only would provide for the next 2 to 3 weeks. What I also understand is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations tried to immediately say it was a non-binding ceasefire because it wasn't covered by Chapter 7 in the United Nations protocols. That then was challenged by experts on the issue and said it was binding. I do also agree that it stipulates the release of the Israeli captives who are in Gaza, who it has to be noted that these captives have been being killed by the Israeli military in its raids on Gaza. In addition to that, I think it's also worth pointing out that the Russian representative to the United Nations attempted to insert the word permanent into the motion and was not able to do that. And that is obviously a cause for concern.
It's definitely not a good sign. Days to come will tell us how bad a sign it is, I'm sure. Dr. Frank Gehly, another old friend of mine, one of life's miracles, an Italian Protestant. Go ahead, Dr. Frank.
Well, George, it seems to me that we have a lesson to learn. The lesson is that at the end of the day, Israel listens only to force, only force. Declarations, resolutions, statements, moral assertions cut no ice with the rulers of state of Israel. Netanyahu doesn't give a damn. So we have to find ways in which can bring force to bear upon the perpetrators of the Gaza genocide. Certainly disinvestment, BDS, the campaign of disinvestment is a strong, powerful tool, but it really hurts. It really hurts the state of Israel and its supporters. And I belong to a group, the Lambeth Witness Group, and we are actually agitating in that way. But I want to be bold enough to say that it would be good if there was an international body like there was, let's say, in Spain during the Civil War, or indeed when Cuba sent fighters to South Africa, to Angola, to fight the South Africans, a body of volunteers who would volunteer to, in some ways, to fight the Israeli butcher of children, the children killers in Gaza, and also eventually, possibly, even states like Brazil under Lula, even possibly South Africa, and maybe, inshallah, some Arab state would actually take the initiative and do something forceful about this monstrous aggression, which has completely disgusted every decent person in the world and which we must not let go unpunished. Punishment, the word punishment belongs to ethics. Perpetrators of crimes should be punished. And we can begin to do that by disinvestment, by BDS, but there are other ways. I support the idea of a body of volunteers who would actually go and fight this oppression in Palestine.
I'm not sure how that could happen. The states through which it would be necessary for volunteers to pass are members of what Loki memorably called the Axis of Assistance. So the boundaries of the dichotomy between the Axis of Resistance and the Axis of Assistance would have to alter for that to happen. Tariq Othman is a Palestinian in Luton, in the south of England. Tariq, welcome. What's your take on these things?
George, I mean, the take is self-explanatory, as everyone has been explaining so far. What we are seeing is, of course, important, and I do think represents a sort of fork in the road for Israel. The discussion it has now, the choice it has now, is to continue isolating itself, to force it into a position where it no longer has any friends, as it now is becoming orphaned by its usual Western parents, or it can decide to move towards a more reconciliatory path and become more peaceful and fundamentally change its Zionist core. But I think related to what many others have been talking about and what you have just mentioned, what is it that we can do? You know, maybe we aren't able to go into and fight with the Axis of Resistance, as you mentioned. But what is it we can do here in Luton, in London, in the UK, to replicate some of your successes that you've had in Rochdale, for example, and turn them into more powerful and effective successes that can do more of what we've seen in the United Nations today?
Well, I'll be speaking in Luton soon. I hope you come along to the meeting. I have some ideas in that regard. It's not realistic for people in Western countries to travel to Gaza. In any case, frankly, there are enough fighters in Gaza. The resistance is not defeated. What is necessary is to change the balance of power in the region and the balance of power in the world, in the Western world. The old world is dying, that much is obvious, but the new world really is struggling to be born. That's why we are in this extended period under the rule of monsters. The power, growing power, no doubt, of countries like Russia, China, Iran, South Africa, Brazil, is not yet powerful enough to say, halt, no more, no further. We will not accept any more of this. And if you don't stop it, we'll be landing our own ships on your beach that you hope to turn into beachfront properties. We're not yet at that stage. That much is clear. But the Axis of Resistance in the region is growing more powerful. I suppose the question, I'm going to ask Dr. Marwa this, the question is, how secure are those on the thrones of the Axis of Assistance? Can we look for any change in their behavior or any change in them being replaced by someone else? Dr. Marwa.
Well, change in their behavior, that's a big no-no, because they are part of the colonial system that was installed in the region. They are an extension to the regimes found in the West. Now, them be ousted, that has to do with how powerful their the natives of those countries are against those regimes. And it's a big debate that could take a lot of time to research and talk about the minorities that are being oppressed and how can they stand in the face of these regimes. But I have a suggestion concerning what your lovely priest was suggesting. And you said it's not applicable because you have access of assistance countries. But I don't want you to forget that there is Lebanon and there is the Mukawama in Lebanon and there's the Saraya Mukawama in Lebanon, which actually accepts anyone who would like to come and take part in the fight against Zionist Israel, because, you know, we have 120 kilometers between us, give or take 100 plus or minus 120 kilometers between Lebanon and occupied Palestine. And just as Zionist Israel brought about from all over the world mercenaries to help out in this genocide against our people in Palestine from all over the world, despite the fact that they say they are natives to Palestine, which they are not, we can also do that. How? Well, you have to go to the people who are capable of doing that, but Lebanon always welcomes whoever wants to fight against Zionist Israel.
Lebanon
and to
will
fight
always be there. I entered this Arab world through the portals of Lebanon in 1977. I've never been able to escape, Dr. Marwa. Thank you to you, to Fra Hughes, to Loki, our panelists, to all of the studio audience, and my apologies for those of you who didn't get in. Have it out with Galloway. It's been marvelous for me. I hope it was for you, and if it was, come back for Have It Out with Galloway. Come and have a go if you think you're hard enough.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Limelight. Palestinian children in Gaza are not starving to death because farmers had a dry season. The starvation of children is a political choice made by the Zionist regime and buoyed by the Biden administration's complicity. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Thank you. Middle East I wrote, 28 Palestinians, nearly all children, have starved to death in Gaza in recent days, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Tomorrow, that number will increase, and the next day, it will climb even higher. Starvation is not a death of natural causes in a world that grows and produces more than enough food to feed everyone. Palestinian children in Gaza are not starving to death because farmers had a dry season. The starvation of children is a political choice made by the Zionist regime and buoyed by the Biden administration's complicity. Israeli regime authorities have continually blocked and severely restricted the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza. So far in March, an average of 168 aid trucks have crossed into Gaza on a daily basis, far below the 500 trucks that entered Gaza daily before October 7th, and nowhere close to what is needed to prevent more children from starving to death. Very little, if any, of the aid reaches isolated Palestinians in northern Gaza, and Israeli regime forces have attacked Palestinians trying to reach it. On February 29th, around 120 Palestinians were killed after Israel opened fire on a crowd of hungry people trying to get aid from a convoy of trucks in Gaza City in what was dubbed the Flower Massacre. Those in the crowd were desperate for a bag of flour to make bread for their families. The massacre received some condemnation from world leaders, but as usual, no one took any concrete action to hold the Zionist regime forces accountable to ensure it never happens again. The Biden administration, for its part, seems to have given up on using its influence to pressure Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to allow aid trucks into Gaza. Just a day after the Flower Massacre, President Joe Biden announced that the United States would airdrop aid into northern Gaza, a move quickly criticized by humanitarian groups as inefficient, ineffective, and widely expensive compared to trucks, which can carry much more and have been lined up outside of Rafah crossing waiting to enter. In addition, airdrops come without a distribution plan. Those who are strongest and fastest can get to the aid first, while those who are sick and weak go without. The airdrops were a public relations move from the outset, and they turned deadly when parachutes malfunctioned and the falling boxes killed five Palestinians. The irony of the United States funding both the bombs and the aid boxes falling from the sky that kill Palestinians is lost on nobody. Biden's latest plan to build a floating pier where aid can be delivered to Gaza leaves more questions than answers. How long will it take? How much will it cost? What is the distribution plan? Is it anything more than a cover to set up a U.S. military base off the coast of Gaza? For the children of Gaza, the answers will come too late. Humanitarian and hunger experts comprising the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, Famine Review Committee issued a report on December 21st, raising the alarm that 80% of Palestinians in Gaza were in Phase 4, emergency, or phase 5, catastrophe, on the scale of acute food insecurity. The report also warned that the risk of famine increases every day as conditions worsen. That report was published more than 3 months ago, and many of its predictions have come true. Palestinians, including children, are dying of hunger. Recently, the IPC issued an updated report indicating that famine is imminent in North Gaza between now and May, and that the conditions necessary to prevent famine have not been met since its first report was issued in December. We have no time to lose. Malnutrition is a slow death affecting young children, the elderly, people with disabilities, and pregnant and breastfeeding women first. It is both preventable and treatable if enough healthy food is available and doctors have the necessary resources. UNICEF estimates that when children with severe acute malnutrition are treated, there is an 80 to 90% rate of success. In a place like Gaza, where Israeli regime forces kill Palestinians trying to reach bags of flour and severely restrict the amount of aid that enters, that rate plummets. The health ministry has confirmed that 24 children in Gaza have died of malnutrition and dehydration, but the official count only includes children who were hospitalized or whose families reported their deaths to the ministry. Which is to say, we don't really know the true scale of how many children are starving to death in Gaza. The healthcare system has collapsed, and with continuous Israeli regime airstrikes and ground troops occupying Gaza, many Palestinians aren't able to reach the few hospitals that are still operating. There is not enough clean water or food, and diseases such as diarrhea, which prevents the absorption of nutrients, are spreading rapidly. Genocide is not only the mass killing of a population. It also involves attacking the conditions that make life possible, sources of food, water, medicine, and more. Children in Gaza cannot wait for Biden to airdrop enough food for 2 million people or build a pier in the Mediterranean Sea large enough to accept cargo ships or whatever plan he will announce next week to demonstrate how unserious his administration is about preventing Palestinian children from starving to death. Palestinian children need a lasting ceasefire that guarantees Israeli regime authorities will permit huge amounts of humanitarian aid to enter, and they need it today. Cancer, the new trailblazers.
One of the oldest and most widespread diseases in the world, cancer has always existed and is found in all living things, including plants. It was once thought to be related to the humours, to be contagious or viral in origin. Today it is believed that the cause may be genetic. In every age, new weapons have been unsheathed against cancer, but none have succeeded in vanquishing it. And yet scientists now are able to decipher some of its most intricate processes. Could these advances have been misleading? Could they have in fact led the scientific community astray?
It now appears very likely that we got lost in the details. Our focus was wrong. We were looking at the details of the engine in the car when that wasn't really the problem.
We tend to research the details without seeing the big picture. We lose the forest for the trees.
Einstein said, for an idea that people don't think is crazy in the beginning, there is no hope.
Thank you. time has come in America when the same kind of concentrated effort that split the atom and took man to the moon should be turned toward conquering this dread disease.
It's now been over 40 years since the war against cancer was declared by one government or another.
Le cancer ne sera pas vaincu en un jour.
Today I'm announcing we are directing $30 million of that new budget.
Since then, real progress has been made. We are now able to detect, treat, and prevent cancer much better than in the past. 70% of the cancers that were fatal in the 1950s can now be cured. But such undeniable achievements are, in the end, relatively minimal. In spite of the many billions that have been invested in cancer research in the last half century, mortality rates have not decreased as much as expected. The disease continues to kill 8 million people every year. But how well do we really know this enemy? And to begin with, how do we define it?
Cancer is the dangerous overproliferation of certain cells in the body. When everything interacts in a harmonious way, the body grows. That's what happens in children or in fetal development. When cells multiply in what we call a normal way, the process is harmonious and coordinated. But when the cell proliferation does not respect this process and gets out of line, so to speak, that's what we call cancer.
I mean, you have to remember what cancer is. Cancer is a kind of traitorous cell in your own body, and that's one of the things that makes it so diabolical, so difficult to treat. It's your own flesh and blood that has become immortal. The cancer cell is an immortal cell. People don't realize this, but all of our cells are destined to die, and it's actually the death of the cell that's healthy. Our cells regenerate it through death. They're constantly growing. But if a cell stays alive and keeps growing, that is what cancer is.
Where does this paradoxical explosion of life that is cancer come from? How can it be prevented and controlled? Surgery was first used to treat cancer in the 19th century, and then, at the beginning of the 20th century, radiation therapy was developed. Both methods target the tumor, which is a cluster of cancer cells that form in an organ. But these methods do not prevent some of the cells from escaping and spreading to other organs. The resulting secondary tumors, called metastases, are often highly malignant. In order to stop this fatal process, a new weapon was developed in the 1950s. On December 2, 1943, German warplanes bombed the town of Bari in Italy. One of the ships in the harbour exploded. It was carrying 2,000 bombs of mustard gas, a highly toxic poison gas. Over the next few months, more than 1,000 people died, both soldiers as well as civilians. The doctors who treated the victims poisoned by the gas noticed that they had very few white blood cells in their blood. This incident led researchers to come up with a new idea. If mustard gas could kill blood cells, why not use similar toxic chemicals to eliminate cancer cells? That was the beginning of chemotherapy. A few years later, it was being used effectively against previously incurable cancers. However, chemotherapy hits hard and indiscriminately. It kills diseased cells as well as healthy cells. It is a scorched earth strategy applied to the entire organism that is extremely harsh on the body. Its side effects range from nausea to hair loss, to anemia and other immune system disorders. Moreover, while some cancers respond to it, others resist it, for reasons that we are still unable to explain.
The idea of using chemotherapy against cancer was purely pragmatic. We don't know why a particular tumor responds specifically to such and such an agent. However, what we suspected was that chemotherapy acted and could be especially effective on rapidly proliferating cells. That's why pediatric tumors were good targets. But unfortunately, this explanation turns out to be insufficient. So we have made advances, but we do not necessarily understand why we made those advances.
While cancer treatment has progressed significantly, many grey areas remain with regard to the disease itself. In the 1970s, it was thought that the mystery had finally been pierced. Two researchers, Harold Varmus and Michael Bishop, demonstrated for the first time that the enemy might come from within their own cells. It could even be lurking in our genes. For this discovery, they were awarded the Nobel Prize. In order to understand this, we must return to the basic principles of the science of genetics. They postulate that DNA controls everything in our bodies. Cancer occurs when something disrupts the codes that regulate the way everything functions in the body. A gene that is damaged, broken, or undergoes mutation may cause cells to deviate from their genetic programming.
When certain cells start to go out of control, which is the case with cancer, they are no longer following their genetic programming. What happens in this process, which is called mutation, is that the cells change their own DNA. So the DNA is altered, the control mechanism is impaired, and as a result, they escape genetic regulation. That's what is now called the genetic theory, or the mutational theory of cancer, which states that cancer is caused by mutations that occur in cancer cells.
A new era is dawning. Researchers began using new techniques to hunt for oncogenes, those genes whose mutations are the cause of cancer. Robert Weinberg is an iconic figure in the field of cancer genetics. Following in the footsteps of Varmus and Bishop, his work has helped to greatly elucidate the biological factors at work in the development of cancer.
In 1978, we began an experimental procedure that allowed us to demonstrate a year later that, in fact, if one looks into the DNA of cancer cells, one can find their damaged genetic information that is responsible for driving the unconfined, the unconstrained proliferation of human cancer cells. The DNA that we looked at there turned out to be a cancer-causing gene, which is called an oncogene. The oncogene is a damaged form of a gene that resides in normal human DNA, and under the influence of the chemical carcinogen, this gene is mutated, it's altered, so that its altered sequence information now creates an oncogene that persuades the cell to grow without limit, without any confinement, and to grow and form thousands, millions, billions of descendants.
Vast amounts of human and financial resources are thus being poured into the area of oncogene research. Billions are being invested in equipment and technology. The human genome is being mapped. And we will soon know everything there is to know, not only about cancer, but about many other diseases as well. The genetic approach now stands out as the one and only path.
I do think that there is by now a commitment to genetics. There is a commitment in our National Institutes of Health. How could there not be? Our director is a geneticist. We have by now an enormous infrastructure of biotech companies built over the last 50 years to work with laboratory scientists to study the genetics of this and the genetics of that.
Today, we have dozens of countries across the world really involved in the race to actually sequence cancer genomes, find cancer genomes. So the science of cancer is really progressed very quickly because we now understand genetics and genomes and we can actually catalog mutations.
Canadian scientist Thomas Hudson runs a large international consortium that is in the process of completing the sequencing of 25,000 tumors.
Our ability to not just discover cancer genes, but rapidly understanding the biology of the cancer genes, and try to make drugs for the most important ones, is actually becoming almost routine.
When I was studying the rise of oncogene research, it was a new bright star, right? It was a hope. People really thought that we were getting to the cause, the basic causes of cancer, and that it would eventually lead to solutions, to treatments.
In the late 1990s, drugs designed to target and affect the behavior of cancer-causing genes were developed. Next to chemotherapy, these so-called targeted treatments appear to be considerably less destructive. Their impact on the body is gentler, with fewer side effects. The pharmaceutical industry has invested massively in these new therapies. which represent more than half of the anti-cancer drugs now being developed. 200 products are already on the market, and 900 are in preparation.
There are a lot of advances happening in oncology today because of targeted therapies. And we know that some, like Gleevec, actually have a long response. But the disappointment is many of the new targeted therapies don't last as long. And so there's limitations in terms of their effectiveness for patients. It could be, you know, 3 months, a year. But very often the disease comes back and can overcome that resistance.
Drugs such as Gleevec and Herceptin have without question contributed to advances in the treatment of certain leukemias and breast cancers. But for almost all of the other cancers, the results have been disappointing.
In principle and logically, targeted therapy is much more promising. The unfortunate outcome, however, is that targeted therapy often works brilliantly, but after 6 or 7 or 8 months, the cancer cells figure out a new way to start proliferating, and these newly formed cancer cells are no longer affected by the initially introduced drug.
It means that we would become caught up in a never-ending chain of events without ever really arriving at a cure. That, I think, is one of the limitations of targeted therapies.
Why is it taking so long for the genetic revolution to come up with effective treatments? It is now estimated that over 2,000 genes might be involved in various cancers, and that the mutation rate could be 1,000 times higher depending on the tumor. And the further we probe, the more complicated it gets.
The major challenge that we have is to understanding what the data means. I was part of the Human Genome Project during the 1990s, and we sequenced that whole genome. It took 10 years, and we still don't understand most of the genes and the proteins and what the genomes do. So we still, our ability to do an interpretation of one genome, a whole community of scientists across the world is still challenged. It's how difficult it is.
The information, the technology for analyzing cancer cells is now so powerful that we are being inundated, we are being flooded with large amounts of information that vastly exceed our capabilities of digesting the information and understanding its implications. Clearly, without understanding what makes cancer cells grow abnormally, our hands are tied in terms of being able to create new kinds of therapies.
There are people who cynically would say, if you have a hammer, every problem is a nail. Cancer genes are now the nails. Because we have molecular genetic tools, we can go and hammer on cancer genes. So the question of, is this the best way to study cancer? Was it the best way? It was, in a certain sense, the best way given the tools that people had. Was it the solution to the problem of cancer?
In the early 1990s, patient advocacy groups were formed in protest against this fixation on genetics. They criticized its lack of therapeutic results. The organization Breast Cancer Action was founded in San Francisco in order to get cancer research out of its rut by challenging, first of all, its dogmatic focus on genetics. Yes, inherited gene mutations may increase the risk of cancer, but only in 5 to 10% of the cases.
When I was diagnosed, that there was a way in which the doctor just wanted to take what he had in front of him. That's to say, you know, a 36-year-old person with this stage breast cancer, and therefore they need this treatment, and throw me into the numbers.
I had a really smart doctor say, well, you don't have a family history. And they said, you can't have breast cancer. And I, oh, okay. And I nodded along, but I did have breast cancer, and I was, you know, had done all those things you're supposed to do. And I felt like it was a revolution for me to find out the things I found out.
Inheriting a gene does not mean that you will get breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And we really do have to look at the inherited gene and environment interactions and why for some people it leads to cancer and for some mm-hmm. people it doesn't.
But I think in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been so much concentration on genetics. And I see it in other diseases where they've accounted for the incidence of these various diseases because of genes that they've identified that people have in common. I don't know how that affects breast cancer, but I know that in general that this investment that genetics explains everything has kind of put things off track.
Could the scientific community have been on the wrong track for the last 30 years? Have we in fact come to a dead end?
By looking at these details, it looks as if we lost the forest for the trees, as Americans would say. And the holistic view became less prominent.
Back in the 1970s, research by American biologist Mina Bissell tended to prove that cancer arises from an interaction between certain cells and their environment. She was one of the first scientists to challenge the genetic theory of cancer.
When you take these cells from the person and put it in a dish, or from an animal and put it in the dish, the genes are not fixed. They are regulated by context. They are regulated by microenvironment. So that just clarified a lot of things for me, that, again, context or microenvironment. And in this case, the architecture of the tissue was very, very important. And once you destroyed the architecture, that, in combination with the oncogene, could make a tumor.
But at the time, the budding sphere of genetics was monopolizing all of the attention, and Mina Bissell's work was virtually ignored.
People say Mina is a pioneer. They say she's a visionary. Some people say. Some people think I'm crazy still. But no, I didn't think as a... I never thought. I just was curious. We published the papers in very many good journals, and the reactions basically were disbelief, or nobody paid attention. People would not quote them. They would not say this. It's only in the last 10 years or so that a lot of very well-known people are aware of the work, and they quote it, and they also say it's pretty obvious.
In order to understand cancer, do we need to change our focus? Should we examine cells in interaction with their environment? Consider how they breathe, eat, and develop. Observe them like we would observe an animal or a plant living within an ecosystem.
In a forest, if there's a plant or an animal species that proliferates to the point of destroying the ecosystem, that is literally the equivalent of cancer in the body. Rather than seeing the body as something that functions under the centralized control of our DNA, if we see it as a self-regulating system, like a forest or an ocean, we will then start to look at how the element that is proliferating gets access to nutritional resources, and we'll study the predators. So, for example, if a certain type of rabbit suddenly begins to multiply to the point of destroying the forest, we're not going to say, oh, the rabbit has mutated. We would wonder instead if carrots hadn't become more abundant for some reason, or if some of the other species that would normally compete with the rabbits hadn't disappeared. Or whether the foxes that kept a check on the rabbit population hadn't some kind of problem that year. And so all of a sudden, instead of looking for mutations, you're faced with a more global vision of balances and imbalances.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The Lord Most High has chosen for us certain followers, Shiites, who assist us. If we are joyful, they are joyful. And if we are sorrowful and sad, they are sorrowful and sad."
in the limelight.
The blood of the Palestinian martyrs and the tears of their children will always remain an eloquent, if tragic, testimony to the utter hypocrisy of Western human rights crusaders and the prevalent unjust world order. Just as apartheid was declared a crime against humanity and a threat to world peace, there cannot be peace in the world with the presence of Zionism. Zionism and the Zionist entity should not be allowed to exist in the community of nations. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, "Even before the creation of Israel from the rib of terrorism, this settler colonial entity weaved a web of lies and myths to hide its litany of crimes against humanity. This apartheid entity developed a very sophisticated propaganda machine known as Hasbara. Hollywood played a role in spreading these myths, producing films such as The Exodus and Ben-Hur. Mainstream media spread lies such as land without people for a people without land, that Zionism was a national liberation movement. It called resistance by the indigenous occupied people terrorism. The ethnic cleansing and collective punishment were enabled by the United States of America, Britain, Germany, France, and other settler colonial states such as Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. All these countries were settler colonial entities that decimated the indigenous populations of the lands they occupied. These same countries continue to support the apartheid Zionist entity with arms, diplomatic cover, and financial aid. What possesses a people, themselves erstwhile victims, that can perpetrate such horrendous crimes we have been witnessing for the last 6 months in Gaza?" Zionist ideology is a fundamental pillar of Israel. It is a racist, apartheid settler colonial state that believes Palestine should be exclusively Jewish, without any Palestinians, Muslim, or Christians. They insist that Palestinians must be expelled from that land. It perfected an ideology that dehumanized the indigenous population. It regards the indigenous population as subhuman, unleashing its military might that would inflict death and destruction on the innocent, infants, and women. The perpetrators of such horrors have no conscience, are without remorse, and act with impunity. Zionism indoctrinated into the Jewish people of a toxic mix of fear, anti-Palestinian sentiment, rewarding Israeli settler colonialists for aggression against Palestinians, all of which has bred a lack of empathy in Israelis towards the Palestinians. Fear among Israelis is sustained through militarization, reframing resistance as terrorism, remembering past atrocities such as the Holocaust, constant accusations of anti-Semitism, and focusing on perceived and manufactured threats. These ensure the settler population's continued support for aggressive, expansionist, racist, and genocidal policies. All settler colonial endeavors, including South Africa's, typically depend on depicting the targeted territory as uninhabited and its existing inhabitants as inhuman barbarians unworthy of any land. This portrayal allowed Zionists to displace the indigenous population of Palestine without moral columns, portraying the establishment of Israel not as the destruction of a people, but as the construction of a civilized villa in the jungle. And if there is any resistance by the indigenous population, call them simply terrorists. The South Africans know well that the terrorist label is in fact a badge of honor. South Africa's former president, Nelson Mandela, was on the U.S. terrorist list right up to 2008. Zionism is a racist settler colonialist movement, which opportunistically coops aspects of Judaism. This enterprise is based on the mass expulsion of the Palestinians and usurpation of their land for the exclusive use of Jews. Zionism means occupation, ethnic cleansing, unending massacres, bombardment of entire civilian population, wars of aggression, dispossession, exile, systematic racism, and apartheid-style separation. Zionism means that there will be massacres until the establishment of a Jewish-only state in Palestine. Jewish in the sense of giving privileges to Jews and denying almost all the rights of the indigenous Palestinians. It is not surprising, then, that they would ignore the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, international humanitarian law, and arrogantly dismiss any judgments by any international institution that rule against Israel. Just as white supremacy in South Africa gave rise to apartheid, Bantustans, inferior education, job reservation, group areas, etc., Jewish supremacy in Palestine gave rise to apartheid, exclusively expulsion, and now genocide. Unless the occupiers of Palestine are de-Zionized, injustice against the Palestinians will continue. There will be no end to the killings because it has become embedded in the psyche of the Zionists to dominate and enslave those it perceives as lesser human beings. They have done this for the last 75 years without accountability. It is the courage of the South African government that, for the first time in the Zionist regime's history, it has been taken to task for its egregious crimes against humanity. And this challenge is not only against the racist Israeli entity, but also against those Western regimes that back Israel and the shameless Arab rulers who care more about protecting their illegitimate thrones than human rights and justice. The world today is divided between a minority of powerful imperialist white supremacists and their puppets who support the genocide of the Palestinians and the majority of the people who do not. The ICJ decision places the Zionist regime squarely in the company of genocidal white colonial settler societies. As South Africa's moral voice, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, stated, "If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor." The Palestinian struggle for liberation, self-determination, and self-rule is actually a war. They fight on behalf of the liberation of the exploited.